Welcome to Techtopia, our new segment on the technologies set to disrupt our future and some of the unexpected questions we may need to ask about them. Joining us each week to help explain these emerging technologies is Steve Sammartino. He brings an unusual perspective as both a technology entrepreneur who advises businesses on the digital era and an author who takes a big picture look at technological disruption. Over the next 8 weeks, we'll be looking at inventions that a couple of decades ago, sometimes even just a couple of years ago, seemed futuristic. We'll be finding out about Bitcoin and the future of money, how soon we could see superhumans, how far we should trust artificial intelligence, and what our phones know about us. And we'll be joined by an expert in the field each week. First up, driverless cars. Does the idea of a car with no steering wheel or brake pedal scare you? Well, I'm afraid you'll have to get used to it. Autonomous cars are already here. South Australia legalised manufacturers to road test them earlier this year, and Telstra's chief scientist predicts that all cars on Australian roads will be driverless by 2030. Joining me in our Sydney studio for the first of our Techtopia series is entrepreneur and technology author Steve Sammartino.
Hello.
And today in our Melbourne studio, we're also joined by Gerard Waldron, the Managing Director of the Australian Road Research Board, which carries out research for the transport industry and government organisations, and which ran the trial for the driverless car in South Australia. First to you, Steve, should we believe the hype that we'll all be in driverless cars within a decade or so?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it'll happen a little bit quicker than most people think. The thing that's different with technology that's information-based is that it moves a lot faster than industrial technology. We have the Moore's Law impact. For those who are uninitiated, that's the doubling of computing power every 18 months and the halving of the price. So what that means, now that a car is a rolling computer, in 18 months it's twice as good, in 36 months it's four times as good, and in 5 years it's eight times as good as it was before. So it'll have an exponential rate of improvement, and we know that they already work, so it's going to come sooner than most people think.
So if we're not driving the car, who or what is? Is it software? Is it a computer road interface? How does it work?
Yeah, it's actually a number of those things. But the first thing that a self-drive car does is it asks itself the same questions a human does. And there's fundamentally four questions that it goes through. The first of those is, where am I? The second is, what's around me? What's likely to happen next? And what should I do about it? And so the self-drive car has a number of sensors, just like a human does, except it's got far more than two eyes. It has a GPS locator, and it knows the things around its environment. And so the software makes an assessment based on what it sees with its sensors and with its cameras, and whether or not that's a cat, a dog, a pedestrian, a cyclist, a truck. And it has a probability calculation about what's going to happen next. And then the car makes a decision on what it should do: drive forward, slow down, stop, and turn. And the software tells actuators, which are little mechanical things that tell the car exactly what to do, put on the brakes or the accelerator, and it just does those things in the same way that a human would do, but it's calculating what's happening at thousands of times per second, and so it can be far more efficient than a human with two eyes and two ears and two hands.
Gerard Waldron, to bring you in now, your research group ran the driverless car trial in Adelaide, the first open road trial, in fact, in the Southern Hemisphere. What does a driverless car feel like to be in?
Well, good afternoon, Eleanor. Look, it feels very like just being a passenger in any other car. And I perhaps should just give you the example of Jay Weatherall accompanied me in the first journey in that car, and he expressed some trepidation at the prospect, but within a kilometre or so was just having a very natural conversation with the Volvo employee who was behind the wheel but not actually driving the car, and more or less ignoring the fact that nobody was driving the car. And so I think we'll get used to the feel of it very, very quickly. It's just like riding in a taxi or any other vehicle that somebody else is taking the driving task on.
And now, Gerard, you're advising governments on how to deal with this new technology, and you've warned them that they need to be clever about how they position themselves so that the community gets the promised benefits. What are you concerned about?
Look, I start off with an economic concern, I suppose. At the moment, we sort of think that our access to the road network is free because we don't pay for it directly, except perhaps when we pay a road toll. But of course, you know, we pay a lot of tax in our fuel, about 35 cents a litre. We pay our state governments for registration fees and licence fees and all those sorts of things. And all of that money, or a large part of that money, goes back into maintaining and developing the road network. So in the first instance, one of the dangers with driverless cars from a government point of view is that there will be a convergence of three technologies, the driverless, some sort of Uber-esque sharing of vehicles and probably electrification of many of those vehicles. And so they're not going to pay fuel tax. Nobody needs a driver's license to be behind to be a passenger in them. And so all of the revenue that's currently supporting the existing road network is going to evaporate. And so some new mechanism needs to be found, and we really need to be proactive about establishing that framework so that we don't end up with a whole lot of service providers building their business models on the assumption that they don't have to pay for the network.
And using the public infrastructure. I guess the biggest concern I hear from people about this technology when I've talked to them about it is safety. And that crash of a Tesla car last month is not easing nerves.
In May, 40-year-old Brown was killed when his Tesla, driving with the autopilot feature activated, collided with a semi-trailer as it turned left across a Florida intersection.
Now, Steve, you say that the danger point in new inventions is often where humans and technology interact. With this crash, we now know that neither acted and the car ran under a truck. What lessons should we draw from this crash?
I think that Tesla made a bit of an error in terms of what they call their technology. Now, it's not a fully autonomous technology, but it was called autopilot. And semantics are incredibly important to humans. I mean, language is our core operating system. And so just slight nuances in the language that might represent what the technology can do can have dramatic impacts. So in this transition period, the way we educate consumers and road users on what the possibilities are of the technology becomes incredibly important.
So what about, though, in a completely autonomous car? How does it make the decision about who to protect and who to sacrifice in the event of an accident? I mean, a human driver will always instinctively save themselves, but will we be seeing cars killing their owners for the greater good?
Well, that's where it gets interesting, because the challenge in technology is not just the tech itself, it's the ethical considerations. And often ethics are something that happen over a time where we have these experiences and we decide as a society what is acceptable and what is civilized. But the idea that a car needs to choose between running over a pedestrian or hurting its passenger, killing a dog or having a car crash, any of these examples are important ones. And the thing that I'm worried about is who gets to make this decision? I mean, is it the decision of the car manufacturer to make the decisions to make? Is it the driver that does it? Is it the government and the road safety authorities? Do you hop in your car and say, please insert your death preferences? I mean, these are important considerations that we need to take into account before the technology gets on the road. And the danger is that we won't have a time where all cars are autonomous. We've got this introduction period where we're mixing human and autonomous technology. And that's where the nuances and the complexity really arises.
Jared, what's your take on that? I mean, does Australia yet have a national plan on how to deal with these sorts of ethical and moral questions?
Look, it doesn't, but I'd firstly like to back the truck up just a little bit and point out that one of the major benefits that we expect to receive from going to automated driving is a big reduction in crashes, deaths and injuries, and probably in the order of 90% or better once we have a predominantly automated driving function.
That's a pretty extraordinary statistic, isn't it?
It is, and a huge economic benefit too, because the cost of not having road safety in Australia at the moment is about $27 billion a year. So, you know, it's sort of 9% of the federal budget, if you like, is what we pay for crashing cars and injuring people. So once we get down to the sort of issue that Steve's talking about, that's we're dealing with a small proportion of the 10% where there is some option to kill one person rather than another, if you like. But I would absolutely agree with anyone who would suggest that that's not the vehicle manufacturer's or the service provider's decision. That's a decision society needs to make. Mm-hmm. And I would say that society should look at this technology as part of its public transport network and decide, you know, exactly how it wanted to apply it.
Now, we're talking at the moment about how a computer is working when it's working as programmed. But, Steve, what about computer error? Can we trust the artificial intelligence in the car's computer not to go rogue? Like, I always, you know, what comes to mind for me in these scenarios is HAL from the movie 2001.
Yeah, well, I think that it's artificial narrow intelligence rather than super intelligence, which means that it only has a specific set of things that it can do. But I think there's a bigger concern with cars being hacked rather than it going rogue. And if a car is hacked, and we've seen that before with the Jeep earlier this year, then the liability there becomes an interesting thing for insurers and for governments as well, because with digital rights management, usually the software that you get in any item is something that you license and you don't own. So a car that is driven by software, you actually don't own the software, you're licensing it. And so if it does get hacked into, then surely that is the responsibility of the manufacturer. But I think things like hacking or cars going rogue, those small instances, or the ethical considerations of who to crash, we need to be very careful not to let items that are low probability and high outrage to stop the overall benefits of a self-drive car, which will save thousands of lives in Australia and millions around the world, because certainly all of the safety improvements we've seen in cars, whether it's seat belts, ABS brakes, speed cameras, the ability to test all of that, that is what is saving lives on roads.
How worried, though, Jared, are governments about hacking? Because you can't make the network completely secure, can you? And, of course, lives are at stake.
Well, firstly, my colleagues in the Australian Driverless Vehicle Initiative are discussing these sorts of issues at every of their conferences and seminars at the moment. And the federal government has actually put a fair bit of emphasis in its innovation strategy into cybersecurity. So the public transport network and driverless vehicles as part of it are all going to be integrated into that overall concern about cybersecurity, and will benefit from all of the work that's being done in the space.
So let's just take a look at who is pushing this technology. Google, or Alphabet as its parent company is now called, is the most advanced of the non-car manufacturers, but Apple's also investing. And every major traditional car manufacturer is also experimenting with driverless cars. Let's have a listen to this.
The F-15 Luxury in Motion looks like a futuristic spaceship on wheels. The car can completely drive itself. The driver's seat rotates 360 degrees so the driver doesn't even have to face forward while on the road.
Now, that's one of the traditional car manufacturers, but Steve, Google shocked other players in this field in 2012 when it announced how far it had advanced in trialling the driverless car. Is there any doubt that Google wants to dominate this technology?
Yeah, I think there's zero doubt, especially now that cars are rolling computers. And I think that not having legacy infrastructure for a car which is really changing its shape and how it operates gives new players a massive advantage.
In terms of legacy issues, I guess one thing to deal with here is privately owned cars. Just briefly, Steve, will the private car survive, or will we be looking at autonomous cars in fleets run by Google, with software run by Google?
Yeah, well, I hope the private car survives. I need somewhere to put my golf clubs, but they're mobile storage devices. But I think that the financial benefits will really override. If you can get a car at a moment's notice summoned to take you where you need at a fraction of the cost, it's inevitable.
Now, Jared, you mentioned to me earlier that you're a bit of a petrol head, but do you think the whole notion of, you know, cars as a private sanctuary will be killed off in this technological disruption?
Look, I don't think it's an active killing off. I think that consumers will make a choice. And, you know, to some extent, that choice is going to be rational and economically based. Ford has announced its driverless vehicle plans and indeed the notion that it will become a mobility provider rather than a seller of cars. And they're predicting that the cost of a ride in one of their cars will be about 20% of the cost of running a ride in a taxi. And I just point out to you that taxis are much cheaper in the USA than they are here. So we are talking about a fairly low-cost service, if you like, or the option of tying a lot of capital up in a car that's sitting on the driveway 22 hours of the day. In fact, for nationally, we would predict that we could do with about one-third of the number of cars on the road that we have now, and that would mean that would liberate something like 200 $6 billion of capital that you could invest back into your mortgage or some other more productive use than a car that you hardly get to drive.
So it's going to drive some big changes, and of course there will be winners and losers. And I guess one of the things we'll lose is the parent-teacher ritual of learning how to drive. I guess that's an open question about whether that is a win or a loss. That's all from Techtopia this week. Thank you to our panellists, Jared Waldron, Managing Director of the Australian Road Research Board, and business technologist Steve Sammartino.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan.
And today's discussion will be available on the World Today website as a podcast. Join us again next Thursday when we take a look at the future of money.